ever dreaming that in the next century, people would be sharing shameful secrets in this room. When she'd gotten up this morning, Celeste had been sure she wouldn't come. She intended to ring up and cancel as soon as she got the children to school, but then she'd found herself in the car, putting the address into the GPS, driving up the winding peninsula road, thinking the whole way that she would pull over in the next 5 minutes and call them up and say, so sorry, but her car had broken down. She would reschedule another day. But she kept driving, as if she were in a dream or a trance, thinking of other things, like what she'd cook for dinner. And then, before she knew it, she was pulling into the parking area behind the house and watching a woman coming out, puffing furiously on a cigarette as she opened the door of a banged-up old white car. A woman wearing jeans and a crop top, with tattoos like awful injuries all the way down her thin white arms. She'd envisaged Perry's face, his amused, superior face.
You're not serious, are you? This is just so...
so lowbrow. Yes, Perry, it was. A suburban counselling practice that specialised in domestic violence. It was listed on their website, along with depression and anxiety and eating disorders. There were two typos on the homepage. She'd chosen it because it was far enough away from Pirawee that she could be sure of not running into anyone she knew. Also, she hadn't really had any intention of turning up. She just wanted to make an appointment, to prove she wasn't a victim, to prove to some unseen presence that she was doing something about this. Our behaviour is lowbrow, Perry, she'd said out loud in the silence of the car, and then she'd turned the keys in the ignition and gone inside.
Celeste? Prompted the counsellor now.
The counsellor knew her name. The counsellor knew more about the truth of her life than anyone in the world besides Perry. She was in one of those naked nightmares where you just had to keep walking through the crowded shopping centre while everyone stared at your shameful, shocking nudity. She couldn't go back now. She had to see it through. She'd told her. She'd said it very quickly. Her eyes slightly off-center from the counsellor's, pretending she was keeping eye contact. She'd spoken in a low, neutral voice, as if she were telling a doctor about a revolting symptom. It was part of being a grown-up, being a woman and a mother. You had to say uncomfortable things out loud. I have this discharge. I'm in a sort of violent relationship. Sort of. Like a teenager, hedging her words, distancing herself.
Sorry, did you just ask about weapons?
She recrossed her legs, smoothing the fabric of her dress across them. She'd deliberately chosen an especially beautiful dress that Perry had bought for her in Paris. She hadn't worn it before. She'd also put on makeup. Foundation, powder, the whole kit and caboodle. She wanted to position herself, not as superior to other women. Of course not. She didn't think that, not in a million years. But her situation was different from that woman in the parking lot. Celeste didn't need the phone number for a shelter. She just needed some strategies to fix her marriage. She needed tips. 10 top tips to stop my husband from hitting me. 10 top tips to stop my hitting him back. Yes, weapons. Are there any weapons in the house? The counsellor looked up from what must be a standard sort of checklist. For God's sake, thought Celeste. Weapons? Did she think Celeste lived in the sort of home where the husband kept an unlicensed gun under the bed? No weapons, said Celeste, although the twins have lightsabers. She noticed that she was putting on a well-bred private schoolgirl sort of voice and tried to stop it. She wasn't a private schoolgirl. She'd married up. The counselor smiled politely and noted something on the clipboard in front of her. Her name was Susie, which seemed to indicate a worrying lack of judgment. Why didn't she call herself Susan? Susie sounded like a pole dancer. The other problem with Susie was that she appeared to be about 12 years old, and quite naturally, being 12, she didn't know how to apply eyeliner properly. It was smudged around her eyes, giving her that raccoon look. How could this child give Celeste advice on her strange, complicated marriage? Celeste should be giving her advice on makeup and boys. "Does your partner assault or mutilate the family pets?" said Susie blandly.
"What? No. Well, we don't have any pets, but he's not like that."
Celeste felt a surge of anger. Why had she subjected herself to this humiliation? She wanted to cry out absurdly, "This dress is from Paris. My husband drives a Porsche. We are not like that."
"Perry would never hurt an animal," she said.
"But he hurts you," said Susie.
"You don't know anything about me," thought Celeste sulkily, furiously. "You think I'm like the girl with the tattoos, and I am not. I am not."
"Yes," said Celeste. "As I said, occasionally we become physically
violent."
Her posh voice was back. "But as I tried to explain, I have to take my share of the blame."
"No one deserves to be abused, Mrs. White," said Susie. "They must teach them that line at counselling school."
"Yes," said Celeste, "of course, I know that. I don't think I deserve it. But I'm not a victim. I hit him back. I throw things at him. So I'm just as bad as he is. Sometimes I start it. I mean, we're just in a very toxic relationship. We need techniques. We need strategies to help us, to make us stop. That's why I'm here."
Susie nodded slowly. "I understand.
Do you think your husband is afraid of you, Mrs. White?"
"No," said Celeste, "not in a physical sense. I think he's probably afraid I'll leave him."
"When these incidents have taken place, have you ever been afraid?"
"Well, no. Well, sort of." She could see the point that Susie was trying to make. "Look, I know how violent some men can be, but with Perry and me, it's not that bad. It's bad. I know it's bad. I'm not delusional. But, see, I've never ended up in the hospital or anything like that. I don't need to go to a shelter or a refuge or whatever they're called. I have no doubt you see much, much worse cases than mine, but I'm fine. I'm perfectly fine."
"Have you ever been afraid that you might die?"
"Absolutely not," said Celeste immediately. She stopped. "Well, just once. It was just that my face... he had my face pressed into the corner of a couch."
She remembered the feeling of his hand on the back of her head. The angle of her face meant that her nose sort of folded in half, pinching her nostrils. She'd struggled frantically to free herself, like a pinned butterfly.
I don't think he realized what he was doing, but I did think just for a moment that I was going to suffocate."
"That must have been very frightening," said Susie, without inflection.
"It was a bit." She paused. "I remember the dust. It was very dusty."
For a moment, Celeste thought she might cry. Huge, heaving, snotty sobs. There was a box of tissues sitting on the coffee table in between them for just that purpose. Her own mascara would run. She'd have raccoon eyes too, and Susie would think, "Not so upper class now, are you, lady?" She pulled herself back from the brink of debasement and looked away from Susie. She studied her engagement ring. "I packed a bag that time," she said. "But then, well, the boys were still so little, and I was so tired." On average, most victims will try to leave an abusive situation 6 or 7 times before they finally leave permanently, said Susie. She chewed on the end of her pen. "What about your boys? Has your husband ever..." "No!" said Celeste. A sudden terror took hold of her. Dear God, she was crazy coming here. They might report her to the Department of Community Services. They might take the children away. She thought of the family tree projects the boys had taken into school today. The carefully drawn lines connecting each of them to their twin, to her, and to Perry. Their happy, glossy faces. Perry has never, ever laid a finger on the boys. He is a wonderful father. If I ever thought that the boys were in danger, I would leave. I would never, ever put them at risk. Her voice shook. "Well, that's one of the reasons I haven't left, because he is so good with them. So patient. He's more patient with them than me. He adores them." "How do you think..." began Susie, but Celeste interrupted her. She needed her to understand how Perry felt about his children. "We had so much trouble getting pregnant. Or not getting pregnant. Staying pregnant. I had 4 miscarriages in a row. It was terrible." It was like she and Perry had endured a 2-year journey across stormy oceans and endless deserts. And then they'd reached the oasis. Twins. A natural pregnancy with twins. She'd seen the expression on the obstetrician's face when she found the second heartbeat. Twins. A high-risk pregnancy for someone with a history of recurrent miscarriage. The obstetrician was thinking, "No way." But they made it all the way to 32 weeks. The boys were preemies. So there was all that going back and forth to the hospital for late-night feeds. We couldn't believe it when we finally got to bring them home. We just stood there in the nursery staring at them. And then, well, then those first few months were like a nightmare, really. They weren't good sleepers. Perry took 3 months off. He was wonderful. We got through it together. "I see," said Susie. But Celeste could tell she didn't see. She didn't understand that she and Perry were bound together forever by their experiences and their love for their sons. Breaking away from him would be like tearing flesh. "How do you think the abuse impacts your sons?" Celeste wished she would stop using the word abuse. "It doesn't impact them in any way," she said. "They have no idea. I mean, for the most part, we're just a very happy, ordinary, loving family. We can go for weeks, months even, without anything out of the ordinary." Months was probably an exaggeration. She was starting to feel claustrophobic in this tiny room. There wasn't enough air. She ran a fingertip across her brow, and it came back damp. What had she expected from this? Why had she come? She knew there were no answers, no strategies, no tips and techniques, for God's sake. Perry was Perry. There was no way out, except to leave, and she would never leave while the children were little. She was going to leave when they were at university. She'd already decided that. "What made you come here today, Mrs. White?" said Susie, as if she were reading her mind. "You said this has been going on since your children were babies. Has the violence been escalating recently?" Celeste tried to remember why she'd made the appointment. It was the day of the athletics carnival. It was something to do with the amused expression on Perry's face that morning when Josh asked him about the mark on his neck. And then she'd gone home after the carnival and felt envious of her cleaners because they were laughing. So she'd given $25,000 to charity. "Feeling philanthropic, were you, darling?" Perry had said wryly a few weeks later when the credit card bill came in. But he'd made no further comment. "No, it hasn't been escalating," she said to Susie. "I'm not sure why I finally made an appointment. Perry and I went to marriage counselling once, but it didn't... Well, nothing came of that. It's hard because he travels a lot for work. He'll be away again next week."
"Do you miss him when he's away?" said Susie.
It seemed as though this wasn't a question on her clipboard. It was just something that she wanted to know. "Yes," said Celeste. "And no."
"It's complicated," said Susie.
"It's complicated," agreed Celeste. "But all marriages are complicated, aren't they?"
"Yes," said Susie.
She smiled. "And no." Her smile vanished. "Are you aware that a woman dies every week in Australia as a result of domestic violence, Mrs. White?"
"Every week."
"He's not going to kill me," said Celeste. It's not like that."
"Is it safe for you to go home today?"
"Of course," said Celeste. "I'm perfectly safe."
Susie raised her eyebrows.
"Our relationship is like a seesaw," explained Celeste. "First one person has the power, then the other. Each time Perry and I have a fight, especially if it gets physical, if I get hurt, then I get the power back. I'm on top."
She warmed to her theme.
It was shameful sharing these things with Susie. But it was also a wonderful relief to be telling someone, to be explaining how it all worked, to be saying these secrets out loud. "The more he hurts me, the higher I go, and the longer I get to stay there. Then the weeks go by, and I can feel it shifting. He stops feeling so guilty and sorry. The bruises, I bruise easily, well... the bruises fade. Little things I do start to annoy him. He gets a bit irritable. I try to placate him. I start walking on eggshells, but at the same time, I'm angry that I have to walk on eggshells. So sometimes I stop tiptoeing. I stomp on the eggshells. I deliberately aggravate him because I'm so angry with him and with myself for having to be careful. And then it happens again.
So you've got the power right now, said Susie, because he hurt you recently.
Yes, said Celeste. I could actually do anything right now because he still feels so bad about what happened the last time with the Lego. So right now everything is great, better than great. That's the problem, see? It's so good right now, it's almost...
She stopped.
"Worth it," finished Susie.
"It's almost worth it."
Celeste met Susie's raccoon eyes. "Yes." The blandness of Susie's gaze said nothing at all, except, "Got it." She wasn't being kind and maternal, and she wasn't reveling in the delicious superiority of her own kindness. She was just getting the job done. She was like that brisk, efficient lady at the bank or the telephone company who just wants to do her job and untangle that knotty problem for you. They sat in silence for a moment. Outside the office door, Celeste could hear the murmur of voices, the ringing of a telephone, and the distant sounds of traffic passing on the street outside. A sense of peace washed over her. The sweat on her face cooled. For 5 years, ever since it had begun, she'd been living her life with this secret shame draped so heavily on her shoulders. And for just a moment, it lifted, and she remembered the person she used to be. She still had no solution, no way out, but for just this moment, she was sitting opposite someone who understood. "He will hit you again," said Susie. That detached professionalism again. No pity, no judgment. It wasn't a question. She was stating a fact to move the conversation forward. "Yes," said Celeste. "It will happen again. He'll hit me. I'll hit him. It will rain again. I will get sick again. I will have bad days. But can't I enjoy the good times while they last? But then why am I here at all?" "So what I'd like to talk about is coming up with a plan," said Susie. She flipped over a page on her clipboard. "A plan," said Celeste. "A plan," said Susie. "A plan for next time." Chapter 34. Have you ever wanted to experiment with that, what's it called, erotic asphyxiation? Said Madeline to Ed as they lay in bed. He had his book, she had the iPad. It was the night after she'd taken the cardboard over to Jane's place. She'd been thinking about Jane's story all day.
"Sure, I'm up for it. Let's give it a shot."
Ed took off his glasses and put down his book, turning to her with enthusiasm.
"What? No! Are you kidding?" said Madeline.
"Anyway, I don't want sex. I ate too much risotto for dinner."
"Right, of course. Silly of me."
Ed put his glasses back on.
"And people accidentally kill themselves doing that. They die all the time. It's a very dangerous practice, Ed."
Ed looked at her over the top of his glasses.
"I can't believe you wanted to choke me," said Madeline.
He shook his head.
"I was just trying to show my willingness to accommodate."
He glanced at her iPad.
"Are you looking up ways to spice up our sex life or something?" "Oh, God, no," said Madeline, with perhaps too much feeling.
Ed snorted. She looked at the Wikipedia entry for erotic asphyxiation. "So, apparently, when the arteries on either side of the neck are compressed, you get a sudden loss of oxygen to the brain, so you go into a semi-hallucinogenic state." She considered it. "I've noticed whenever I've got a head cold, I often feel quite amorous. That might be why."
"Madeline," said Ed, "you have never been amorous when you had a head cold."
"Really?" said Madeline. "Maybe I just forgot to mention it."
"Yeah, maybe you did."
He went back to reading his book again.
"I had a girlfriend who was into it."
"Seriously? Which one?"
"Well, maybe she wasn't theoretically a girlfriend. More like a random girl."
"And this random girl wanted you to..."
Madeline put her hands around her own throat, stuck her tongue out the side of her mouth, and made choking noises. "God damn, that looks sexy when you do that," said Ed.
"Thanks."
Madeline dropped her hands.
So, did you do it?
Sort of half-heartedly, said Ed. He grinned to himself, remembering. I was a bit drunk. I was having trouble following instructions. I remember she was disappointed with me, which I know you probably find impossible to fathom, but I didn't always thrill and delight.
Yes, yes.
Madeline waved him quiet and looked back at her iPad. So, why the sudden interest in erotic asphyxiation? Said Ed. She told him Jane's story and watched the tiny muscles around his jaw flicker and his eyes narrow, the way they did when he heard a story on the news about a child being hurt.
Bastard, he said finally. I know, said Madeline, and he just gets away with it.
Ed shook his head. Silly, silly girl, he sighed. These sort of men just prey on... Don't call her a silly girl. Madeline sat up so fast the iPad slipped off her legs. That sounds like you're blaming her. Ed held up his hand as if to ward her off. Of course I'm not. I just meant, what if it were Abigail or Chloe? Cried Madeline.
I actually was thinking of Abigail and Chloe, said Ed. So you'd blame them, would you? Would you say, you silly girl, you got what you deserved?
Madeline, said Ed calmly. Their arguments always went like this. The angrier Madeline got, the more freakishly calm Ed became, until he reached a point where he sounded like a hostage negotiator dealing with a lunatic and a ticking bomb. It was infuriating.
You're blaming the victim.
She was thinking of Jane sitting in her cold, bare little apartment, the expressions that had crossed her face as she shared her sad, sordid little story. The shame she so obviously still felt all these years later. I have to take responsibility, she'd said. It wasn't that big a deal. She thought of the photo Jane had showed her. The open, happy, carefree smile. The red dress. Jane once wore bright colours. Jane once had cleavage. Now Jane dressed her bony body apologetically, humbly, like she wanted to disappear. Like she was trying to be invisible, to make herself nothing. That man had done that to her. It's all fine and dandy for you to sleep with random women, but when a woman does, it's silly. That's a double standard. Madeline, said Ed, I was not blaming her. He was still speaking in his, I'm the grown-up, you're the crazy one voice, but she could see a spark of anger in his eyes.
You are. I can't believe you would say that.
The words bubbled out of her.
You're like those people who say, oh, what did she expect? She was drinking at 1 o'clock in the morning, so of course she deserved to be raped by the whole football team. I am not. You are so.
Something changed in Ed's face. His face flushed. His voice rose.
Let me tell you this, Madeline, he said. If my daughter goes off one day with some wanker she's only just met in a hotel bar, I reserve the right to call her silly.
It was stupid for them to be fighting about this. A rational part of her mind knew this. She knew that Ed didn't really blame Jane. She knew her husband was actually a better, nicer person than she was, and yet she couldn't forgive him for that silly girl comment. It somehow represented a terrible wrong. As a woman, Madeline was obliged to be angry with Ed on Jane's behalf, and for every other silly girl, and for herself, because after all, it could have happened to her too. And even a soft little word like silly felt like a slap.
I can't be in the same room as you right now.
She hopped out of bed, taking the iPad with her.
Be ridiculous then, said Ed.
He put his glasses back on. He was upset, but Madeline knew that he would read his book for 20 minutes, turn off the light, and fall instantly asleep. Madeline closed the door firmly. She would have preferred to slam it, but she didn't want the kids waking up, and marched down the stairs in the dark.
"Don't hurt your ankle on the stairs," called out Ed from behind the door.
He was already over it, thought Madeline. She made herself a cup of chamomile tea and settled down on the couch. She hated chamomile tea, but it was supposedly soothing and calming and whatever, so she was always trying to make herself drink it. Bonnie only drank herbal tea, of course. According to Abigail, Nathan avoided caffeine now too. This was the problem with children and marriage breakups. You got all this information about your ex-husband that you would otherwise never know. She knew, for example, that Nathan called Bonnie his Bonnie Bon. Abigail had mentioned this in the kitchen one day. Ed, who had been standing behind her, silently stuck his finger down his throat, making Madeline laugh. But still, she could have done without hearing that. Nathan had always been into alliteration. He used to call her his Mad Maddie. Not quite as romantic. Why had Abigail felt the need to share those sorts of things? Ed thought it was deliberate, that she was trying to bait Madeline, to purposely hurt her. But Madeline didn't believe that Abigail was that malicious. Ed always saw the worst in Abigail these days. That's what was behind her sudden fury with him in the bedroom. It wasn't really anything to do with the silly girl comment. It was because she was still angry with Ed over Abigail moving in with Nathan and Bonnie. Because the more time that passed, the more likely it seemed that it was Ed's fault. Maybe Abigail had been teetering on the edge of her decision, playing around with the idea but not really seriously considering it, and Ed's "calm down" comment had been just the shove she'd needed. Otherwise, she'd still be here. It might have just been a passing phase. Teenagers did that. Their moods came and went. Lately, Madeline's mind had been so filled with memories of the days when it was just her and Abigail that she sometimes had the strangest feeling that Ed, Fred, and Chloe were interlopers. Who were these people? It was like they'd marched into Madeline and Abigail's life with all their noise and their stuff, their noisy computer games and their fighting, and they'd driven poor Abigail away. She laughed at the thought of how outraged Fred and Chloe would be if they knew she dared question their existence, especially Chloe. "But where was I?" she always demanded when she looked at old photographs of Madeline and Abigail. "Where was Daddy? Where was Fred?" "You were in my dreams," Madeline said, and it was true. But they weren't in Abigail's dreams. She sipped her tea and felt the anger slowly drain from her body. Nothing to do with the stupid tea. Really, it was that man's fault. Mr. Banks. Saxon Banks, an unusual name. She rested her fingertips on the cool, smooth surface of the iPad. "Don't Google him," Jane had begged, and Madeline had promised. So this was very wrong, but the desire to see the bastard was so irresistible. It was like when she read a story about a crime, she always wanted to see the offender, to study his or her face for signs of evil. She could always find them. And it was so easy, just a few keystrokes in that little rectangle. It was like her fingers were doing it without her permission. And while she was still deciding whether or not to break her promise, the search results were already on the screen in front of her. As if Google were an extension of her mind and she only had to think of it for it to happen. She would just take a very, very quick look. She'd just skim it with her eyes and then she'd close the page and delete all references to Saxon Banks from her search history. Jane would never know. It wasn't like Madeline could do anything about him. She wasn't going to plan some elaborate, satisfying revenge, although already part of her mind had split off and was travelling down that path. Some sort of scam? To steal his money? To publicly humiliate or discredit him? There must be a way. She double-clicked, and one of those well-lit corporate headshots filled her screen. A property developer called Saxon Banks, based in Melbourne. Was that him? A strong-jawed, classically handsome man with a pleased-with-himself smirk and eyes that seemed to look straight into Madeline's in a combative, bordering on aggressive way. "You prick," said Madeline out loud. "You think you can do whatever you want to whomever you choose, don't you?" What would she have done in Jane's situation? She couldn't imagine herself reacting the way Jane had. Madeline would have slapped him. She wouldn't have been undone by the words fat and ugly, because her self-confidence about her looks was too high. Even when she was 19, or especially when she was 19, she got to decide how she looked. Perhaps this man specifically picked out girls who he knew would be vulnerable to his insults. Or was this line of thought just another form of victim blaming? "This wouldn't have happened to me. I would have fought. I wouldn't have stood for it. He wouldn't have shattered my self-respect." Jane had been completely vulnerable at the time. Naked. In his bed, silly girl. Madeline caught herself. Silly girl. She'd just thought exactly the same thing as Ed. She'd apologize in the morning. Well, she wouldn't apologize out loud, but she might make him a soft-boiled egg, and he'd get the message. She studied the photo again. She couldn't see a resemblance to Ziggy. Or, actually, maybe she could. Perhaps a little around the eyes. She read the little biography next to his photo. Bachelor of this, masters of that, member of the Institute of whatever, blah, blah, blah. In his spare time, Saxon enjoys sailing, rock climbing, and spending time with his wife and three young daughters. Madeline winced. Ziggy had three half-sisters. Madeline knew this now. She knew something she shouldn't know, and she couldn't unknow it. She knew something about Jane's own son that Jane herself didn't know. She hadn't just broken a promise. She'd violated Jane's privacy. She was a tacky little voyeur poking about the internet, digging up photos of Ziggy's father. She'd been angered by what happened to Jane, but part of her had almost relished the story, hadn't she? Hadn't she almost enjoyed feeling outraged over Jane's sad, sordid little sex story? Her sympathy came from the superior, comfy position of someone with a life in proper middle-class order. A husband, a home, a mortgage. Madeline was just like some of her mother's friends, who had been so excitedly sympathetic when Nathan left her and Abigail. They were sad and outraged for her, but in such a tut-tut that's oh-so-terrible way that left Madeline feeling brittle and defensive, even as she genuinely appreciated the home-cooked casseroles that were solemnly placed on her kitchen table. Madeline stared into Saxon's face, and he seemed to stare back at her with knowing eyes, as if he knew every despicable thing there was to know about her. A wave of revulsion rushed over her, leaving her feeling clammy and shaky. A scream sliced like a sword through the house's sleepy quiet. "Mummy! Mummy! Mummy! Mummy!" Madeline leapt to her feet, her heart hammering, even though she already knew it was just Chloe having another one of her nightmares. "Coming! I'm coming!" she called as she ran down the hallway. She could fix this. She could so easily fix this, and it was such a relief because Abigail didn't want or need her anymore, and there were evil people like Saxon Banks out there in the world waiting to hurt Madeline's children in big ways and small ways, and there wasn't a damn thing she could do about it. But at least she could drag that monster out from under Chloe's bed and kill it with her bare hands. Chapter 35. Miss Barnes. After that little drama on orientation day, I was steeling myself for a tough year, but it seemed to get off to a good start. There were a great bunch of kids, and the parents weren't being too annoying. Then, about halfway through the first term, it all fell apart. 2 weeks before the trivia night. Latte and a muffin. Jane looked up from her laptop and then down again at the plate in front of her. A curl of steam rose languidly from a chunky, fragrant muffin dusted with icing sugar. Oh, thanks, Tom, but I didn't order. I know. The muffin is on the house, said Tom. I hear from Madeline that you're a baker, so I wanted to get your expert opinion on this new recipe I'm trying. Peach, macadamia nut, and lime. Crazy stuff. The lime, I mean. I only bake muffins, said Jane. I never eat them. Seriously? Tom's face fell a little. Jane said hurriedly, but I'll make an exception today. The weather had turned cold this week, a little practice session for winter, and Jane's apartment was chilly. That grey sliver of ocean she could see from her apartment window just made her feel colder still. It was like a memory of summers lost forever, as if she lived in a grey, brooding, post-apocalyptic world. God, Jane, that's a bit dramatic. Why don't you take your laptop and set yourself up at a table at Blue Blues? Madeline had suggested. So Jane had started turning up each day with her laptop and files. The cafe was filled with sun and light, and Tom had a wood fire stove running. Jane gave a little exhalation of pleasure each time she stepped in the door. It was like she'd gotten on a plane and flown into an entirely different season compared with her miserable, damp apartment. She made sure that she was only there in between the morning rush and the afternoon rush, so she didn't take up a paying table. And, of course, she ordered coffees and a small lunch throughout the day. Tom the barista had begun to seem like a colleague, someone who shared the cubicle next to hers. He was good for a chat. They liked the same TV shows, some of the same music. Music? She'd forgotten the existence of music, like she'd forgotten books. Tom grinned. I'm turning into my grandma, aren't I? Force-feeding everyone. Just try one mouthful. Don't eat it all to be polite. Jane watched him go, and then averted her eyes when she realized she was enjoying looking at the breadth of his shoulders in his standard black T-shirt. She knew from Madeline that Tom was gay, and in the process of recovering from a badly broken heart. It was a cliché, but it also seemed to be so often true. Gay men had really good bodies. Something had been happening over the last few weeks, ever since she'd read that sex scene in the bathroom. It was like her body, her rusty, abandoned body, was starting up again of its own accord, creaking back to life. She kept catching herself, idly, accidentally looking at men, and at women too, but mainly men, not so much in a sexual way, but in a sensual, appreciative, aesthetic way. It wasn't beautiful people like Celeste who were drawing Jane's eyes, but ordinary people and the beautiful ordinariness of their bodies. A tanned forearm with a tattoo of the sun reaching out across the counter at the service station. The back of an older man's neck in a queue at the supermarket. Calf muscles and collarbones. It was the strangest thing. She was reminded of her father, who years ago had an operation on his sinuses that returned the sense of smell he hadn't realized he'd lost. The simplest smells sent him to rhapsodies of delight. He kept sniffing Jane's mother's neck and saying dreamily, "I'd forgotten your mother's smell. I didn't know I'd forgotten it." It wasn't just the book. It was telling Madeline about Saxon Banks. It was repeating those stupid little words he'd said. They needed to stay secret to keep their power. Now they were deflating, the way a jumping castle sagged and wrinkled as the air hissed out. Saxon Banks was a nasty person. There were nasty people in this world. Every child knew that. Your parents taught you to stay away from them, ignore them, walk away, say, "No, I don't like that," in a loud, firm voice, and if they keep doing it, you go tell a teacher. Even Saxon's insults had been schoolyard insults. "You smell. You're ugly." She'd always known that her reaction to that night had been too big, or perhaps too small. She hadn't ever cried. She hadn't told anyone. She'd swallowed it whole and pretended it meant nothing. And therefore, it had come to mean everything. Now, it was like she wanted to keep talking about it. A few days ago, when she and Celeste had their morning walk, she told her a shorter version of what she'd told Madeline. Celeste hadn't said all that much, except that she was sorry, and that Madeline was absolutely right, and Ziggy was nothing like his father. The next day, Celeste gave Jane a necklace in a red velvet bag. It was a fine silver chain with a blue gemstone. "That gemstone is called a lapis," said Celeste in her diffident way. It's supposedly a gemstone that heals emotional wounds. I don't really believe that stuff, but anyway, it's a pretty necklace." Now Jane put a hand to the pendant. "New friends? Was that it? The sea air?" The regular exercise was probably helping too. She and Celeste were both getting fitter. They'd both been so happy when they noticed they didn't have to stop and catch their breath when they reached the top of the flight of stairs near the graveyard. Yes, it was probably the exercise. All she'd needed all this time was a brisk walk in the fresh air and a healing gemstone. She dug her fork into the muffin and lifted it to her mouth. The walks with Celeste were also returning her appetite. If she didn't watch out, she'd get fat again. Her throat closed up on cue, and she replaced the fork. So, not quite cured. Still weird about food. But she must not offend lovely Tom. She picked up her fork and took the tiniest bite. The muffin was light and fluffy, and she could taste all the ingredients that Tom had mentioned. Macadamia, peach, lime. She closed her eyes and felt everything. The warmth of the cafe, the taste of the muffin, the by-now familiar smell of coffee and second-hand books. She took another, bigger forkful and scraped up some of the cream. "Okay." Tom leaned over a table close to hers, cleaning it with a cloth he took from his back pocket. Jane lifted a hand to indicate her mouth was full. Tom smiled. He took a book that a customer had left on the table and replaced it on one of the higher shelves. His black T-shirt lifted away from his jeans, and Jane saw a glimpse of his lower back. Just a perfectly ordinary lower back. Nothing particularly notable about it. His skin during the winter was the colour of a weak latte. During the summer, it was the colour of hot chocolate. "It's wonderful," she said. "Hmm?" Tom turned around. There were only the two of them in the cafe right now. Jane pointed her fork at the muffin. "This is amazing. You should charge a premium." Her mobile rang. "Excuse me." The name on the screen said school. The school had only called her once before, when Ziggy had a sore throat.
"Miss Chapman? This is Patricia Lipman."
The school principal. Jane's stomach contracted. "Mrs. Lipman, is everything all right?" She hated the craven note in her voice. Madeline spoke to Mrs. Lipman with cheerful, condescending affection, as if she were a dotty old family butler.
"Yes, everything is fine, although I would like to arrange a meeting with you as a matter of some urgency, if I could. Ideally today. Would around 2 p.m. suit you? Just before pick-up?"
"Of course. Is everything lovely? I'll look forward to seeing you then." Jane put down her phone. "Mrs. Lipman wants a meeting with me." Tom knew most of the kids, parents, and teachers at the school. He'd grown up in the area and attended the school himself back when Mrs. Lipman was a lowly Year 3 teacher.
"I'm sure you don't have anything to worry about," he said. "Ziggy is a good kid. Maybe she wants to put Ziggy in a special class or something."
"Hmm." Jane took another absent-minded forkful of muffin. Ziggy wasn't gifted and talented. Anyway, she already knew from the tone of Mrs. Lipman's voice that this wasn't going to be good news. Samantha. Renata went off her head when the bullying started. Part of the problem was the nanny hadn't been communicating, so it had been going on for a while without her knowing. Of course, we now know that Juliet had other things on her mind besides her job. Miss Barnes. What parents don't understand is that a child can be a bully one minute and a victim the next. They're so ready to label. Of course, I do see this was different. This was bad.
Stew. My dad taught me, a kid hits you, you hit him back. Simple. It's like everything these days. A trophy for every kid in the soccer game. A prize in every bloody layer of hot potato. We're bringing up a generation of wimps.
Thea. Renata must surely have blamed herself. The hours she worked, she barely saw her children. My heart just goes out to those poor little mites. Apparently they're not coping well at the moment. Not coping well at all. Their lives will never be the same again, will they?
Jackie. Nobody says anything about Jeff working long hours. Nobody asks if Jeff knew what was going on with Annabella. It's my understanding Renata had a higher paid, more stressful job than Jeff, but nobody blamed Jeff for having a career. Nobody said, oh, we don't see much of Jeff at the school, do we? No. But if the stay-at-home mums see a dad do pick-up, they think he deserves a gold medal. Take my husband. He has his own little entourage.
Jonathan, they're my friends, not my entourage.
You have to excuse my wife. She's in the middle of a hostile takeover.
that might be why she's coming across a bit hostile. I think the school has to take responsibility. Where were the teachers when all this bullying was going on? Chapter 36. Renata Klein has discovered that her daughter, Amabella, has been the victim of systematic, secret bullying over the last month, said Mrs. Lipman, without preamble, as soon as Jane sat down opposite her. Unfortunately, Amabella won't say what has been going on or who is involved. However, Renata is convinced that Ziggy is responsible. Jane gulped convulsively. It was strange that she still felt shocked, as though some crazily optimistic part of her really had believed that Ziggy was about to be put into some sort of special class for marvellous children.
What sort of...
Jane's voice disappeared. She cleared her throat with difficulty. She felt as though she were playing a role for which she wasn't properly qualified. Her parents should be at this meeting. People of the same era as Mrs. Lipman. What sort of bullying? Mrs. Lipman made a little face. She looked like a lady who lunched. A society wife with good clothes and an expensive skincare regime. Her voice had that crystal clear, "Don't mess with me" quality that was very effective, apparently, even with the famously naughty Year 6 boys. "Unfortunately, we're a little short on details," said Mrs. Lipman. "Amabella does have some unexplained bruises and grazes and a bite mark, and she has only said that someone has been mean to her." She sighed and tapped perfectly manicured nails on the manila folder in her lap. "Look, if it weren't for the incident on the orientation day, I wouldn't have called you in until we had anything more definitive. Miss Barnes says that incident appeared to be a one-off. She has observed Ziggy closely because of what happened, and she describes him as a delightful child who is a joy to teach and appears to be very caring and kind in his interactions with the other children." The unexpected kindness of those words from Miss Barnes made Jane want to weep. "Now, obviously, we have a zero-tolerance policy for bullying at Piriwee Public. Zero. But in the rare cases where we do find cases of bullying, I want you to know that we believe we have a duty of care both to the victim and to the bully. So if we do find that Ziggy has been bullying Amabella, our focus won't be on punishing him, but on ensuring the behaviour stops, obviously, immediately, and then on getting to the bottom of why he is behaving this way. He's a 5-year-old boy, after all. Some experts say a 5-year-old is incapable of bullying." Mrs. Lipman smiled at Jane, and Jane smiled back warily. "But wait, he's a delightful child. He hasn't done this. Apart from what happened on orientation day, have there ever been any other incidents of this sort of behaviour? At daycare, preschool, in Ziggy's interactions with children outside the classroom?" "No," said Jane, "absolutely not. And he always, well," she'd been about to say that Ziggy had always steadfastly denied Amabella's accusation from orientation day, but perhaps that just confused the issue. Mrs. Lipman would think he had a history of lying. "So there is nothing out of the ordinary in Ziggy's past, his home life, his background, that you think we should know? That might be relevant?" Mrs. Lipman looked at her expectantly, her face kind and warm, as if to let Jane know that nothing would shock her. I understand that Ziggy's father is not involved with his upbringing. Is that right?
It always took Jane a moment when strangers casually referred to Ziggy's father. Father was a word that Jane associated with love and security. She always thought first of